can't be Eurocentric in our expectations of what a good novel should be like. We have to open up our horizons. That requires reading extensively from different cultural backgrounds, and I'm not sure we're doing that enough.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. It's been a while since I said that. It's very nice to be back, and thank you very much if you are somebody who was subscribed previously and stayed subscribed for the long wait until the fourth series. I think it will be worth the wait. I think I've got some excellent episodes coming up, not least today's. The voice that you heard at the beginning was that of the Turkish novelist Elif Shafak. Elif has published 19 books, including The Island of Missing Trees, that was her most recent title, and 2019's 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. She's lived an eventful life. In 2006, she faced trial in Turkey for charges of insulting Turkishness in her fiction. She was acquitted, and we talk about that in this episode. She spoke to me from her London home in August, and we talked about why she doesn't believe in a distinction between highbrow and lowbrow literature, how fiction can help us reconnect with the planet, and the role of the translator in expanding our horizons. Before we get started, I'm very happy to say that this week's episode of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the writing school affiliated to the major literary agency. Since launching in 2011, over 135 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including best-selling authors Jane Harper, Claire Pooley, and Jesse Burton. Curtis Brown Creative offer a wide range of online writing courses led by acclaimed authors and industry insiders, including their brand new four-week course, Character Development: The Deep Dive, which starts this month and is open now for enrolment. This course will help you to get to know your protagonist and create characters that will stick in your reader's mind long after they've finished the story. The course features exclusive teaching videos and writing tasks from Curtis Brown Creative's founder, the author and former literary agent Anna Davis, plus the opportunity to get individual feedback from one of Curtis Brown Creative's expert fiction editors. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more about all their current courses. And I'm also very pleased to say that Curtis Brown Creative has provided an exclusive discount for listeners of this podcast. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. And by using that code, you're also supporting me, so thank you. I'll be back at the end and I'll repeat the code then, but for now, over to Elif.
It's a bit chaotic here, you know. I'm not a very well organized person, although I'm very comfortable and happy inside my own chaos.
Yeah.
There are lots of books in this space, lots of notes, papers, manuscripts, a lot of stationery. I really love stationery, pens, pencils of all colors, my computer. Reading glasses and all of that is here, and some small ornaments, some of them from Istanbul, some of them from other cities. Lots of small tiny ornaments that are not necessarily of any value perhaps, but they are of value to me.
Yeah. And is it a room that is specifically devoted to your work, or do you share it with other people in the house?
Mostly it is a room that is dedicated to books. So, I mean, you know, I use it most of the time, the truth is. But there are also books in the staircase, you know, in the bathrooms, everywhere. I think there are books in this house. And that said, I also write from time to time in cafes, in restaurants, in noisy places. I really, really don't mind the noise, so long as it's not directed at me. Actually, what I don't like is complete silence and stillness. That makes me very uncomfortable.
Well, I know a lot has been written about your habit of listening to heavy metal while you're working. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, actually, I've never stopped doing that. I mean, at my age, maybe it looks very odd, but
no.
But I just love it. I just love it.
You said that you love stationery and pencils. Does that mean that you do a lot of writing by hand when you're working?
That bit is a bit tricky because I was left-handed but converted to right-hand at school in Turkey because at the time they thought that's the way it should be done. So I still have a very broken relationship with my both hands. I hate, you know, longhand writing. Even if I have to write a couple of sentences, I get bored, I can't connect. It's only when I'm using a keyboard, that's the only time when my two hands are more coordinated. So I love taking notes, but I can't write an entire book by hand.
Are you writing something at the moment?
No, I'm not. I'm just reading. I do not start a new book immediately, you know, as soon as I finish a book. I have a pendulum, sorry. It's like a pendulum. When I'm writing, writing is always at the center of my life, but I'm an introvert by nature and I become very disconnected. When the book is over, I think I become a relatively more social human being, a relatively more normal human being. I just like to go out and listen and read and discover other areas, disciplines of interest, you know, and just read and research until a story finds me. Yeah. But I don't rush it, you know.
Do you feel that you are absorbing during these periods in order to put something out later?
Indeed, I think absorbing is the right word for that, because I honestly think writers need to be two things all their lives. We need to be good readers and we need to be good listeners. And both of those are about absorbing, you know, absorbing words, emotions, feelings. So just trying to understand this moment in time, trying to listen to other people, what they're saying, their pains, their sorrows. There are writers who have planned the next book, you know, years ahead. I don't do that. I like to just change the energy, observe for a while before I start a new book.
And when you are writing a book, what's your sort of routine with it? Are you somebody who sits down and writes every morning, or how do you approach it?
You know, I've heard some authors, and it's usually male authors of a certain age and maybe certain comforts, who claim to have precise writing routines and schedules. Mm-hmm. They say, you know, they wake up at every morning at the same time, you know, maybe you go out for a walk and then you come back and write. So it's precise and meticulous. My writing schedule is not like that. And I think to be honest, they're all the rest of us. What we're trying to do is we juggle, don't we? I mean, we try to carve out a space and a time zone for ourselves, whether it's during the day or during the night. Toni Morrison had a wonderful essay about this. And of course, she was a single mom, she was an editor and a brilliant novelist. Sometimes she would work during the day, sometimes she would work during the night. And I understand why. So that's all I can say. It's not a precise daily, you know, schedule. But all I can say is I do read every day, you know, whether it's night or day, I try to find the time to read. Even if I can't write every day, I do read every day.
Yeah. And in terms of writing, it's just seizing your opportunities when they arise.
If I'm inside a novel, I do my best to create those opportunities as best as I can. But as you said, it's also seizing those opportunities. So sometimes I write at train stations, you know, airports, on the train, when you're moving from one place to another. When I'm writing a novel, that becomes my world in a way.
When you do have a stretch of time to sit down, are you somebody who produces large quantities of words in one sitting, or do you prefer to write in smaller sort of blocks and then go away from it?
It really varies, because I think it doesn't matter whether it's your first book or 10th book, there's always anxiety, there's always doubt. Some weeks you feel very confident about the story, you know, and it feels like it's flying. And then maybe the next week, it's the opposite and you feel quite down, or you can't produce as much. All of that is part of the writing process. Also, in my opinion, writing is not only, you know, a linear accumulation word after word, page after page. It's also about letting go. It's also about editing, you know, destroying actually what you have written. And we don't talk about that bit as much. But it's not a just a linear, constant construction. I think letting go and deleting and erasing, in a way destroying, is also part of the creative process.
Absolutely. And do you do that in the process of writing a first draft, or are you somebody who wants to get to the end of the first draft and then will go back and kind of slash and burn things and rewrite?
I do both, I think, you know. But what I can tell is, in my opinion, there are two different ways of writing a novel. In the first path, I think the writer wants to know what's going to happen, you know, six pages or six chapters later, how the story is going to end. It's a bit like engineering, and I know terrific books that have been produced in this way. It's more cerebral, if I may put it this way, in which the writer wants to be a little bit like the god of that world. But there's a second path in which I think you write with intuition, with instinct, almost like an animal instinct. Sometimes you put that word just because the previous word demanded. Sometimes you follow your own characters, and the side characters, or the characters that you thought were going to be side characters, become much more important than you initially thought. So in other words, you're a little bit drunk, you know, as an author. You're definitely not the god. You're definitely not above the text. You discover and you follow the flow of the story, its rhythm, but you also follow your characters. I've always felt closer to the second path. So I can, you know, rationalize the process, but in all honesty, while I'm in it, while I'm in that river, I don't think it's a very rational process at all. Mm. You know, actually it feels quite irrational. And I say this even though I know that I do a lot of research. You know, for me, the intellectual component of writing a novel is equally important. I read a lot, whatever about every little subject that is covered in the book. But there comes a moment when you stop intellectualizing, and from that moment onwards, it's just an emotional journey, and it can be quite irrational. And for that, I think you need to allow the story to lead the way. You should let go of your own ego a little bit as an author.
What do you do during those periods when you feel worried that it isn't going well and sad about it? You know, you said some weeks are good and some weeks are bad, and I think that's very familiar to all writers. Mm-hmm. How do you cope with that and keep going?
I mean, you have anxiety attacks, panic attacks, you know. I don't know how well I cope with it, but I walk a lot. I love walking. I love just thinking, especially while I was writing this book. I mean, even seemingly small moments like walking in the park, sitting under a tree, you know, the things that we used to take for granted before the pandemic, of course, you start to rethink understand the importance of those golden moments. I think walking helps me a lot. I love walking in the city, observing, listening, just trying to get out of that zone for a little bit, but then come back with a new energy and return to the story.
What are your early memories of considering yourself a writer? At what point did you start to feel that writing was part of who you were?
I think my need for writing was so existential, and it came to me at a very early age. I started writing fiction in my own limited way since I was a child, to be honest. But that is not because I wanted to become a writer. That is not because I wanted to dedicate my life to books. I didn't know such a thing was possible. There were no writers around me. There were no, you know, role models in that sense. But I was an only child raised by a single working mom and a grandmother. And life was very boring. I was very lonely and I needed books. And this was a very conservative, very patriarchal neighborhood in Turkey, in Ankara. And I think, honestly, books saved me because they taught me that it was possible to, you know, connect with other lives, you know, other possibilities. They opened up my horizons. And for that, I will always be grateful to books. So my need for books was very, very early on present in my life. But my desire to become a writer, that came to me in my early 20s, around the time I was 19 years old. I adopted a pen name. And from that moment onwards, I think I knew I was going to, in a way, dedicate my life to books. You know, I wanted to become an author. I was an aspiring writer when I moved to Istanbul in my early 20s. But I think what precedes that is, as I said, the need for books, the need for imagination and storyland. That runs very deep, and that came to me early on.
Where were you first published? What was your kind of route into publishing?
My first experience, actually, now I understand, because I was so ignorant, I was so young, and I didn't know how difficult the writing journey would be. You know, in Turkey, it is difficult to be a novelist, but it's even more difficult to be a woman writer. I didn't know any of this. I didn't know how words would be heavy. So I finished a novel. I was very young. I was like 23 years old. I sent it to major publishing houses on my own without an agent. And then I received a call from them. And from that moment onwards, it just took off. So now, of course, I realize, you know, some people might see it as courage or confidence, but it was just ignorance. I didn't know the ways, you know. So I thought, why not? Why can't I send it? And I hadn't, maybe I didn't worry at all about what people might say, you know, whether they would like it or not. So there was something very, in a way, pure in that connection, because I just wanted to write. And that was the guiding force for me.
Mm. And that became your first published book, did it?
It did. And it surprised critics a lot in Turkey, because in Turkey, this is a big debate. You know, our language, the Turkish language, was Turkified, which means hundreds and hundreds of words were taken out, old words coming from Persian or Arabic origin. And usually if you're a liberal, or, you know, if you're on the left side of the political spectrum, as we say in Turkey, if you're modern, secular, and a young woman at the time, you're not expected to know old words. Whereas I loved words, whether old or young, I didn't care. So my vocabulary was very rich, and that is because I studied Turkish. You know, I have never taken my mother tongue for granted, partly because I spent some parts of my childhood abroad. So when I came back to Turkey, there were moments when I couldn't understand the jokes, when I couldn't understand the slang, you know, because these things keep moving on.
Mm.
So maybe unlike my peers, people my age, instead of thinking, well, I already know my mother tongue, instead of seeing it as something I possess, I started studying, and I started studying both old Ottoman words but new Turkish words. And I've never stopped ever since. So I love languages in general. And people were surprised by that.
That brings me very neatly onto my next question, actually, which was, you have written widely in both Turkish and in English. And I'm interested in the experience of that for you. Does it feel the same to write in both languages? Do you feel like you're putting on slightly different identities? Do you feel your voice is the same in both languages?
It's not the same, to be honest. And I think I will, of course, I'm aware that I'm an immigrant. You know, my connection with the English language is quite different than my connection with the Turkish language. Turkish is my mother tongue, is the language of my grandmother, and my connection with it is quite emotional. Whereas with the English language, I think it's a more cerebral, more perhaps intellectual connection, which I also need. It was a risk for me to write in a language that was not my native tongue. And I think as immigrants, we always know there will always be a gap between our minds and our tongues. You know, the mind runs faster than the tongue. And you're always trying to catch up, but you're always aware of that gap. And that's quite intimidating. That's quite frustrating. You know, the things I can never pronounce correctly, you know, the things that my kids make fun of, for instance. But it always reminds you that you're a foreigner, that you're an outsider, that you're a latecomer. And yet, you know, something tells you to keep going. I don't know what that is, but maybe it's the need for a sense of freedom. That's what it is for me, writing in English. I feel lighter, you know, and I need that sense of lightness. Being a Turkish writer is very, very heavy. You know, words are heavy. And somehow writing in English gave me a sense of both freedom, but also cognitive flexibility. It's like you take a step back. And interestingly, paradoxically, it also gave me a chance to take a closer look at the culture where I come from, you know, because only when you put some distance between yourself and, let's say, a painting, then you can see it in its entirety. But you need to take, you know, a step back. That said, I think what I like most is the commute between languages. Turkish and English are completely different languages. It's not like, you know, French and English, where they share common vocabulary and grammar. Turkish has a completely different grammar, completely different vocabulary. But I think to this day, if my writing has melancholy, sorrow, longing, I find these things much easier to express in Turkish. But when it comes to humor, which I really, really adore, I love humor, especially compassionate humor. So when it comes to humor, irony, satire, I find them much easier in English.
I mean, it's funny because, of course, the books you've written in English will have been translated into Turkish, and the books that you wrote in Turkish have been translated into English. But do you feel that the books that were originally written in Turkish and the books that were originally written in English have a different character to them, or a you know, could you almost sort them into two piles in that way?
I'm very, you know, grateful to translators who put so much love and effort into ferrying stories from one shore to the next. And, you know, they don't get enough recognition. They're not paid enough money, of course. Their names are not emphasized enough. But we writers and readers, we owe so much to people, you know, who are doing literary translation. It's amazing work. Sometimes people ask me, you know, why don't you translate your own books into Turkish, for instance? I can't do that. It's a completely different type of creativity. Knowing two languages or speaking three languages is not enough in itself. You know, also, I think as a writer, I would change the story a lot. So what I do is, I mean, for the last 15 years we've been doing this, I write in English first, and then every novel is translated into Turkish by a professional translator. And then she hands it to me, and I kind of reshape, or because, you know, I use lots of inverted sentences in Turkish. I have maybe my own vocabulary, my own sense of rhythm. So I shape it a little bit, but I don't touch the essence, of course. In a way, we work together very closely with a translator. And then I come back to the English language. It's insane, to be honest. You have to spend so much time thinking about sentences, the words that can't be translated easily from one language to the other. And if you don't love language, you can't do it, because it really requires a lot of time to commute back and forth like that.
I think it's fascinating. And, you know, hearing you talk about it makes me think about, I think it's so important to delve into this stuff, because it opens you up to the different perspectives of people all over the world, and not just, you know, because language reflects something of how people see the world, I think. I mean, you've been very widely translated, I think, into 54 languages, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I wondered whether you think that in countries where English is the native language, do we read enough international work? And do you think there would be a benefit to people seeking out more writing from other cultures?
I really think we learn so much from differences and from cultural encounters, cosmopolitan encounters. And it worries me so much that we're living in an age in which we're constantly pushed into tribes and tribal identities. To me, it's much healthier and better for the mind and the soul if we could read across the board, both fiction and nonfiction, East and West, you know, read works in translation, but also, of course, in, written in our native languages. But sometimes we seem to forget, and even intellectuals or authors, poets seem to forget, that there are different ways of storytelling, you know, culturally. Of course, I have a lot of respect for the Western canon, you know, this entire tradition of Western novel. I love it, I cherish it, I treasure it. But I'm also aware that there is a more maybe cyclical or circular way of storytelling, which is mostly found in oral culture, you know, of the Middle East, the Balkans, the Levant, Anatolia. I grew up with those stories. So someone coming from, for instance, Chinese background or Middle Eastern background or, you know, South American or African, authors are very familiar with this other oral culture, traditions of oral culture and other types of storytelling. All I'm trying to say is sometimes we forget that there isn't a single way of writing a novel. And I find that very dangerous. So we can't be Eurocentric in our expectations of what a good novel should be like. We have to open up our horizons. That requires reading extensively from different cultural backgrounds. And I'm not sure we're doing that enough.
Mm. In Turkey, you were sued and then acquitted for insulting Turkishness with your novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, which dealt with the Armenian genocide. Did that change the way you felt about approaching the page? You know, I wondered whether it gave you an added sense of responsibility because of the weight of your words in Turkey, or an added sense of caution?
I cannot say that it was an easy experience. It was quite unsettling for me. I wasn't expecting it. Of course, I'm aware that the Armenian genocide is unfortunately a big, big taboo in Turkey, and people don't want to talk about it. And many people sincerely know nothing about it, because even though we are a country of rich, long history, it doesn't mean we have a strong memory of the past. In fact, we're a society of collective amnesia. So our entire relationship with the past is full of ruptures. And into that void, what comes in is ultranationalism, this Turkish nationalism, Islamism, this, you know, illusion that our ancestors always did the right thing, the golden age, imperial nostalgia. That runs very deep in Turkey. So all I'm trying to say is many people are not ready to have a much more nuanced and calmer conversation about the past. And yet I've always believed that memory is a responsibility, not in order to get stuck in the past, but to learn from the past, to recognize people's sorrows, you know, to say I'm sorry, and hopefully to build a better future together. And storytelling can make a difference to rehumanize people who have been dehumanized by, you know, extremist ideologies. When the novel came out, and in my opinion, it was a constructive novel told through the eyes of both Turkish and Armenian women, generations, grandmothers, mothers, granddaughters. When the novel came out, I was accused of insulting Turkishness under Article 301, which was a bit surreal. This article has been used against scholars, historians, journalists repeatedly, but it was the first time it was used against a fiction writer. And that's why it became surreal, because the words of fictional characters were taken out of the book and used as evidence in the courtroom, as a result of which my Turkish lawyer had to defend my Armenian fictional characters.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
It is bizarre, and that went on for over a year. I had to have a bodyguard for a year and a half afterwards. So the whole experience was traumatic, and I think it would have affected me more had I been a non-fiction writer. But because I'm a novelist, and when I write, I go into an imaginary world. And I have to, as I said, you know, I write with my intuition. I let the stories guide me and lead the way. I think even though in my daily life I'm a very anxious person, when I write novels, I change because I have to follow the rhythm of you know, the flow of stories. So only thanks to that, I think it didn't affect me. It didn't affect the stories that I write. But otherwise, of course, it was a very unsettling experience.
You're very passionate about several political and social issues, and they're sort of interwoven into your fiction very cleverly. Tales, you know, relating to freedom of speech or feminism or LGBT rights, history, of course. Do you think you could ever write a story that didn't have a wider resonance in that way, or is it sort of inextricably tied up with the way you see the world?
I really think it's deeply tied up with the way I see the world and perceive the world. So it's not like before I start writing a novel, it's not like there are certain themes in my mind and I try to put those themes into the story. It comes naturally to me. And I think for me, writing has always been maybe paying more attention to the periphery rather than the center. You know, of course, I, as a storyteller, I'm interested in stories, but I'm equally interested in silences. So people who have been silenced, disempowered, disadvantaged, pushed to the margins of the society, whose stories have been forgotten, erased, or distorted. There's a part of me that wants to pay bigger attention to the periphery rather than the center and change that power ratio. Also, maybe because there were many times throughout my life when I felt like the other myself for different reasons. So whoever is the other, for whatever reason, naturally I feel inclined to hear their stories and to reflect their stories. There is that. But there's also, I think, the fact that I stayed in academia for many years and I love interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary work. So, you know, I love reading philosophy, cultural history. I love reading cookbooks, political science, neuroscience. And knowledge is important to me. Learning is important to me. That interdisciplinary background perhaps also seeps into the stories. I feel very sad when I hear, and it's usually male readers who do this, they say, you know, I read politics, I read history, I read philosophy, so much is happening in the world, I read about finance, but I don't have time for fiction. My wife reads fiction. When they say that, I feel sad, because I think in the world of fiction, there's everything. There is psychology, there is history, there is philosophy, there is politics in fiction, and there's so much more. But most importantly, I think we need to read both fiction and nonfiction. And it's only when we are ready to read about disciplines that we know nothing of, then we learn more. So to me, it's much more interesting when a poet becomes interested in political philosophy, or a political scientist becomes interested in film theory, or, for instance, when a film director becomes interested in, you know, poetry. So, like, areas that don't seem to be related to what we're doing, those are the fields that really nourish our intellect, our curiosity. I just want to keep learning, and maybe that diverse interdisciplinary background can also be seen in my novels.
It was interesting before that you mentioned your research and how important your research is to your books, because I wanted to ask you about The Island of Missing Trees. It struck me how painstakingly well researched it was, not only in terms of the conflict in Cyprus, which is one of the themes of the novel, but also there's a huge amount of information in there about nature, about trees and insects, very specialist knowledge of those subjects. And I was really struck by that. How important is research to your fiction? And then the other thing I wondered is, when you're doing that volume of reading, how do you then whittle that down to what will serve the story that you're trying to tell?
Yeah, I think for a long time you feel lost inside this, you know, massive sea of information, knowledge. What guides me is curiosity, you know, almost perhaps a childish curiosity. I think writers should never lose that. Just asking small questions about big things, like, why is it like that? You know, what's the story behind that? we stop asking questions as we grow older, but curiosity is so important. So just to be open to learn new things every single day. I mean, the books that I'm reading are so, you know, eclectic, my reading lists. You know, one week I can read very extensively about butterflies, the next week maybe sewage systems, you know, in Istanbul or in London, completely unrelated books. But in my mind, they come together. And if the story takes me in that direction, into a field of which I know nothing about, I am ready to learn as much as I can about that field. So, you know, as writers, we really have to be curious readers, avid readers. I think reading, learning, just being open to that is a big part of the creative process.
Yeah, I'm doing a creative writing MA at the moment at Birkbeck. Mm-hmm. And when they welcomed us to the course, they told us to read greedily, which I thought was such a good way of thinking about it, and to read everything.
Yeah. And whatever speaks to us, right, in that moment. I've never been a big believer in that, you know, horrible distinction, highbrow literature versus lowbrow literature. I've never understood what that even means, who decides. We can read anything, everything, you know. Maybe 1 week you will read relatively, you know, well-known, famous author, but the next week it will be just something that is not as well-known. Or as I mentioned, you know, from philosophy to cookbooks, you can swing. As long as it speaks to you, speaks to us in that moment, we can read anything and everything.
I think, drawn to unconventional perspectives in your fiction, and in The Island of Missing Trees, of course, a large portion of the book is written from the perspective of a fig tree. Ultimately, the story of the fig tree is a bit more complicated than that, but I won't spoil it for anyone who hasn't read the book. But how do you approach characterization, and how is that complicated when your character is a fig tree?
Yes, I think this is where oral storytelling and written culture come together. You know, as much as I can, I want to bridge these two worlds. As I mentioned briefly, I was raised by a grandmother who was very superstitious. You know, her house was full of spirits and magic and very irrational old traditions. And in her world, everything spoke. Everything had a language. Trees spoke, you know, pebbles, stones, rivers. They mumbled, they grumbled, they complained, and I've never forgotten that. Of course, in our daily life, if I say, well, the tree is speaking, people will think, you know, you've gone bonkers. But in literature, and that's the beauty of art and literature, you can say that, you know, you're not bound, you're not confined, these rules of logic. And in a way, nature does speak. Nature has its own stories. And in a way, of course, trees are wiser than us and they have lived longer than us. And it's such a shame that we still don't know much about trees. You know, they're much more alive than we tend to assume at first glance. So there's still a lot we don't know about plants, about the world around us. And part of it stems from the fact that we as humans tend to think that we're above all creation, that we're the center of the universe, that we, you know, we're the owners of this land. In fact, we're nothing like that. So this is the moment when I think it's like a crossroads with the pandemic, with the climate crisis. We need to reconnect with Earth and we need to be more humble and realize that we're all part of the same circle and no one is higher than anyone else, you know. In Anatolia, the old nomadic tribes, they had these interesting rituals. They would ask the permission of a tree before they had to cut down a tree. You know, I used to think, what a strange thing. But then when you do research, you realize because they didn't think they owned the tree, you know, because they didn't see themselves as the possessors of the nature, it was a different way of understanding. And there's a lot we need to learn from indigenous tribes. And most importantly, I think we need to connect with Earth.
I did feel reading The Island of Missing Trees, as I got deeper and deeper into it, that you were pushing me to consider the world in a way that I wouldn't normally consider it. It was quite eye-opening.
I really appreciate you saying that, because I felt the same way, you know. I think stories, hopefully, they change us a little bit. But when I say us, I think they changed their writers too. So as I kept writing, it really brought me closer to nature, but it also helped me to understand that wherever there has been a civil war or genocide or apartheid, you know, any conflict, ethnic conflict, violence, it's not only human beings that have suffered tremendously. Of course they have, but also they have destroyed entire habitats, entire ecosystems. We never think of human history or world history, I should say, in those terms. And in a way, I wanted to be able to say, you know, nationalisms clash and people keep shedding blood over a piece of land, but that land also belongs to trees. That land also belongs to bees and butterflies. It's not only, you know, human beings that can claim ownership. So I wanted to change the perspective. But to be honest, I have been wanting to write about Cyprus for a very long time. This story has been somehow brewing inside my soul, and I could never dare because it's still an open wound and emotions are very raw. It's only when I found the voice of the fig tree, or when I found the fig tree, that I dared to approach the story because it gave me a completely different angle, and then I felt free.
Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
There's a lot. I mean, you know, when you are a Turkish writer, you are expected to write the stories related to Turkey or Turkish women, which of course I will. But, you know, for me, literature is so much more than that. Or let me put it this way, if you're an Afghan woman writer, nobody expects you to write science fiction or experimental fiction or avant-garde. You're expected to produce stories about Afghan women, for instance, which maybe you will in one book, but maybe the next book is going to be completely, you know, much more avant-garde. So there is some kind of identity politics in publishing that bothers me. I think we need to push those boundaries. Sometimes I find it difficult to also make a case for humor. People, if you come from troubled countries, people don't expect to see humor. They expect to see sorrow, but not humor. However, in a city like Istanbul, I cannot separate humor from sorrow. It's because the city constantly mixes these. And many people coming from India, from Pakistan, from Brazil have said exactly the same thing. You know, in our countries, in our cultures, there is sorrow inside the funniest moments, and there's an element of humor inside the saddest moments. So the dance of humor and sorrow or melancholy, the dialectical relationship, sometimes I find it a bit difficult to make a case for this in the European or Western world.
Could you pinpoint any lessons that you've learned over the years about writing that have really made a difference to your own writing?
I mean, there's so much because it's an endless, ongoing learning process, isn't it? But one thing I can tell is because our lives as novelists, you know, we're solitary creatures. We don't know teamwork. Sometimes we have inflated egos. We think we're gods, you know, we create characters, we kill characters. But so much is, you know, you produce a lot on your own. And that you need to have an inner garden, you know. You really need to love what you're doing. Sometimes you will succeed, sometimes you will fail, you will fall down, you will keep walking. What really matters is, do you really love the art of storytelling? I think in whatever we do in life, whether we're bakers, designers, writers, poets, that love should be alive, you know, for what we're doing. Rumi has a beautiful saying about this. He talks about, you know, the love, that love for what we're doing, what we're producing, shaping us and teaching us constantly. I sincerely believe in that. Mm.
And looking back at your writing career, what do you feel the most proud of?
I don't know. I don't maybe put it in those terms. But what makes me emotional, what is very heartwarming for me, is when I receive a letter from a reader who is maybe in a completely different part of the world. Or, you know, when they share with me something that's very personal, intimate. people come and they say, you know, I've read your work, I've read your this book, and this is what it meant to me. And in that moment, they're telling you something very personal. That can be incredibly moving. I've also seen how in countries like Turkey, a book is not a personal item. Like, you don't put it back on your bookshelf when you've finished reading it. You pass it on. You give it to your best friend, and the best friend shares it with her auntie, and the auntie sends it to, you know, her son who is doing his military service. And then before you know, a group of soldiers are reading the same book. I have seen same copies, a copy of some, let's say, one of my novels, underlined by different colored pens, because maybe on average 5 to 6 people have read the same copy. So that word of mouth, that sharing, is incredibly heartwarming, and it matters a lot to me.
A huge thank you to Elif Shafak. Her latest novel is The Island of Missing Trees, and you can buy that and a selection of her other books in the In Writing shop on bookshop.org, alongside others by guests of the podcast. Any shopping that you do in the In Writing shop is a double good deed, because 10% of your money goes to independent bookshops and 10% comes to me to support the making of this podcast. To find it, go to uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, and I'm also going to put that in the show notes. And a reminder that if you want to take your own writing to the next level, my sponsor Curtis Brown Creative has provided an exclusive discount for you. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. Thank you so much for listening today. It's really nice to be back, and I'm excited about this series, in part because I've actually been able to return to recording some episodes in person. So there are episodes coming up where I actually go to the home of the writer and sit in the room where they write, including next week's episode, which I think is a particularly good one. If you enjoyed today's episode, I would be very grateful if you would share it on social media. And I'll be back next Friday. See you then.